as I said, was to correct him. Not to correct his love, his ardent love, but to correct his conceptualization. He told him that, now, do you know whom you are addressing? Do you know what you are doing in your talking to God? And do you understand that your concepts do not apply to God, are not fit? And then he said to him, of course, this is Rumi's. He said, even a woman's name, you cannot apply it to a man. Fatima, for example, is a woman's name. So if you call a man by that name, so he will become angry at you. So be careful, beware when you are describing God, when you are addressing him. So then, as if like a teacher, he was teaching him how to choose his words, how to train his mind in order to give the best explanation of God and his presence and his being and characteristics and so on. Here, actually, Rumi not only teaches us how to understand the relationship between man and God, but also to understand the business and the function of prophets. Moses here is not only a theologian, but also a prophet. Now, this is the business, the function of prophets, to correct over conceptualizations of God. He is beyond conceptualization, as I said. But since it is inevitable to conceptualize him somehow or other, some pictures are better than some others. So this is the function of prophets, in order to teach us, to show us how to depict God. What is the best picture to be offered, to be depicted? So what actually Moses did to shepherd, the service that he gave to him, and that is actually what prophets usually do, and that's their main job, is to tell us how to conceptualize him when it is inevitable. Though mystics are no prophets, therefore they tell us that God is beyond conceptualizations. But prophets are for the ordinary people. And addressing the ordinary people, they offer them the best pictures, the best concepts that saves them and teaches them how to understand God in a proper way. Now, who is going to read us this whole story? Because it's a lengthy one, and anybody can read us the story in order for me not to be the sole speaker here. And yeah, please.
I have a pleasant thought to it, and I'd love to read it anyway.
You love to read it, but you do not read it.
I will.
You will?
Yes.
Okay, go on. Please, yeah.
Moses heard a shepherd on the road praying, God, where are you? I want to help you to fix your shoes and comb your hair. I want to wash your clothes and take the light off. I want to bring you milk to kiss your little hands and feet when it's time for you to go to bed. I want to sweep your room and keep it neat. God, my sheep and goats are yours. All I can say, remembering you, is A and R. Moses could stand it no longer. Who are you talking to? The one who made us and made the earth and made the sky. Don't talk about shoes and socks with God. And what's this with your little hands and feet? Such blasphemous familiarity sounds like you're chatting with your uncle. Only something that grows needs milk. Only something with feet needs shoes, not God. Even if you meant God's human representative, as when God said, I was sick and you did not visit me. Even then, this tone would be foolish and irreverent. Use appropriate terms. Fatima is a fine name for a woman, but if you call a man Fatima, it's an insult. Body and birth language are right for us on this side of the river, but not for addressing the origin, not for Allah.
Sorry to interrupt you. Just in order to make it more comprehensible to you, perhaps, Rumi here alludes to one of the traditions which comes from the Prophet, that the saints are one and the same. Not one, they are united with God. This is, as I said, one of the traditions that once God said to Moses or one of his prophets that when I was sick, why didn't you come to see me? And he said, God, you cannot become sick. He said, yes, one of my good servants actually became sick. And that is like me becoming sick. So that's what actually Rumi has got in mind here, that there is such a unity between God and his saints, his good servants, that their sickness is God's sickness. Their well-being is God's well-being. Such a closeness between the two. Then, of course, Rumi here says, even in that case, even in that case, you have to be careful not to use the erroneous or non-relevant concepts. Yes? Go on.
The shepherd repented, and Saul had killed, and Saul wandered out into the desert. A sudden revelation came then to Moses, God's voice. You have separated me from one of my own. Did you come as a prophet to unite or to sever?
Okay, this is one of the main principles of Rumi. Prophets are there in order to unite, rather than sever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have given each being a separate and unique way of seeing and knowing and saying that knowledge. What seems wrong to you is right for him. What is poison to one is honey to someone else. Purity and impurity, sloth and diligence in worship, these mean nothing to me. I am apart from all that. Ways of worshipping are not to be ranked as better or worse than one another. Hindus do Hindu things. The Dravidian Muslims in India do what they do. It's all praise and it's all right. It's not me that glorifies acts of worship. It's the worshippers. I don't hear the words, they say. I look inside at the humility. That broken open lowliness is the reality, not the language. Forget phraseology. I want burning, burning. Be friends with your burning. Burn up your thinking and your forms of expression. Moses, those who pay attention to ways of behaving and speaking are one sort. Lovers who burn are another. Don't impose a property tax on a burned out village. Don't scold the lover. The wrong way he talks is better than 100 right ways of others. Inside the Kaaba, it doesn't matter which direction you point your prayer rug. The ocean diver doesn't need no shoes. The love religion has no code or doctrine, only God. So the ruby has nothing engraved on it. It doesn't need marking. God began speaking deeper mysteries to Moses, vision and word, which cannot be recorded here, poured into men through him. He left himself and came back. He went to eternity and came back here. Many times it happened. It's foolish of me to try and say this. If I did say it, it would uproot our human intelligences. It would shatter all writing pens. Moses ran after the shepherd. He followed the bewildered footprint. In one place, moving straight like a calf through, across the chessboard. In another, sideways like a bishop. Now surging like a wave cresting, now sliding down like a fish. With always his feet, making geomancy symbols in the sand, recording his wandering state. Moses finally caught up with him. I was wrong. God has revealed to me that there are no rules for worship. Say whatever and however your loving tells you to. Your sweet blasphemy is the truest devotion. Through you, a whole world is free. Loosen your tongue and don't worry what comes out. It's all the light of the Spirit. The shepherd replied, Moses, Moses, I have gone beyond even that. You applied the whip and my horse shied and jumped out of itself. The divine nature and my human nature came together. Bless your scolding hand and your arm. I can't say what has happened. But I'm saying now it's not my real condition. What I'm saying now is not my real condition. It can't be said. The shepherd grew quiet. When you look in a mirror, you see yourself, not the state of the mirror. The flute player puts breath into a flute. And who makes the music? Not the flute, the flute player. Whenever you speak praise or thanksgiving to God, it's always like this dear shepherd's simplicity. When you eventually see through the veil to how things really are, You will keep saying again and again, this is certainly not like we thought it was.
Okay, thank you very much, indeed. Now, the story is in front of you. This is really wonderful. And as I said, you have to go through it time and again, again and again, in order to discover, I mean, new points every time. You will see, of course, a true pluralism as well in this story, as Rumi actually tells us. Because when he says that all prayers are acceptable to God, and at the end, actually, there is... the translation stops here, but there are some other very important verses which is there in the story. Another point which is very important for our purpose here is that even the Moses is a shepherd himself, you see. When he meets another Moses who is better and above him, so he will realize that he was a shepherd for himself. Therefore, there are a hierarchy of shepherds or Moses in the whole world. And no description, no explanation of God is ever final. Therefore, according to Rumi, everybody, even a philosopher, even a mystic, even a prophet, must consider himself as a shepherd. So long as he has not met his Moses, he thinks that he is correct. He has the best understanding of God. But once he meets his own Moses, he will realize that he has been a shepherd. So simple. In understanding the God and in need of action. So that's how things go and how the story actually teaches us to understand our situation vis-a-vis God, ours, not only ours, I mean, philosophers, theologians, and at the one stroke actually Rumi here tells us the formlessness, the unconceptualizable state of God, and our situation in front of him as shepherds, the function and the job of prophets, the pluralism in religion, and many other points which of course are to be uncovered in the from the body of the story. For example, he says vision and words which cannot be recorded here poured into and through him. So vision and words, this is one of the main teachings of mystics, that when you have got your own mystical experience, vision and words come together. It is not the case that you have got the vision and then you try to verbalize it or to conceptualize it. Those two actually come together. Therefore, in the case of a mystical or religious or transcendental experience, if you like, these two come together. Here, Rumi says that in the case of the Moses, vision and the words, which cannot be recorded here, of course, poured unto him. He left himself and came back. He went to eternity and came back here. Many times this happened. It's foolish of me, to try and say this. So there are many points, but you come imagery of flute or reed at the end, which is again one of their favorite images of Rumi. He never forgets that, because as I said to you, it tells a lot to him, and through it he can teach us a lot. So he's a blower, a player, and then you have got the flute, and you have got the breeze, the wind, and you have got the limitations of the reed, and many things. So through this imagery you learn a lot. And the formlessness, as I mentioned last time. Now there is another thing about the flute which I would like to mention. This time, when we come to this part of the story and we see that Rumi again uses the imagery of the reed, there is another dimension or perhaps another interpretation to the imagery which now is the right time to put our finger on it. In Persian, you know, reed or the flute, what is the word for it? We have mentioned it a number of times here, so I mean the Iranian, non-Iranian Muslim are familiar with the word. What is that? Yes, nay. Let me write this.
So this is like this.
Now, in Persian, nay not only means read, but also means no, like English. Nay means no. That is exactly the meaning of the word nay in Persian as well. It is a literary meaning of the word, and especially in the Afghani accent or dialect, it was much more usual than in proper Iranian Persian dialect. But it is there. I mean, we are very familiar with it, and it is very frequently used in the literary works. So nay has got a double meaning. So let us be clear about it. On the one hand, it is flute, it is cane, it is reed, or whatever other. It is the. It means negation. It means no. Now, another reason why the imagery of nay or flute is so favorable to Rumi is the meaning, the double meaning of the word. You know, he is fond of negation. Fond of negation. The idea of God and the universe. And the man whose main job, whose main function, whose main mystical experience means nothing but negating oneself in God. You see, a kind of annihilation, kind of negation. So that's why even the word nay tells something to Rumi and says something to us. It is not only the flute that transmits the breath of God to the world, that determines, like a window, the light of God to the house of universe. It is not only breath that carries the breath of life to the world, but also one of the characteristics of reed, that it is nothing. It is nay. And this nothingness is one of the main things that Rumi loves a lot. It is an instrument, but at the same time, it is nothing. And in front of the beloved, the lover must declare his nothingness. And reed by its very name actually declares its nothingness, its negation, its annihilation. Look, and Rumi actually does not stop there. He is a poet. He is a Sufi. His power of imagination is so strong, so powerful, that let me read you one of the poems. He has got it in Divan, not in Masnavi, to see how he plays with the word and how he takes us beyond the concept of the negation even in order to make something positive out of something negative. You know, nay is negative, is negativity per se, because it means no, it means not, it means negation. Read you the Persian version first, and then come into the translation to see how he plays with the word, how beautifully, how remarkably. He says, آمده ام که سرنهم عشق تو را به سر برم بر تو بگوییم که نی نی شکنم شکر برم. I am here in presence of you in order to submit myself to you. But if you do not accept me, literally, if you say no, I won't stop there. I will break the nay, the cane, in order to take sugar from it. You understand? Because nay means at the same time cane and at the same time no. But if you say no, I won't leave it at that. I will break the cane in order to take cane sugar from it. So from the bitter no, I will make a sweet, you see, thing. So that is another reason why Rumi is so fond of imagery of reed. By its very name, as I said, it conveys us the message of negation, of nothingness in front of God, of annihilation of the lover in the beloved. In order to make this even, listen to Rumi himself and his imagery about the nothingness of the world and the lover vis-à-vis his beloved, just let me give you a number of other points here, then finish our talk. Okay, listen to this. When you regard the inward as... No. I'm on the third book, the book three of Masnavi. The title of this piece is The Question of Fana and Baqa of the Darwish. The question of the what is it? The non-existence and the subsistence of the Sufi. So there, the line reads like this: the speaker said, "There is no Darwish in the world, and if there be a Darwish, that Darwish is non-existent. Now, either you do not have a Sufi, or if there exists a Sufi, he does not exist." Because this is the main characteristic of a Sufi, not to exist in the sense that he is negated or annihilated in his beloved. So either there is no Darwish, or if there is a Darwish, then there is not. So if there does exist a Darwish, so it, that Darwish necessarily must not exist. So that is the real meaning of this. So he goes on to give us some examples how this works. So he gives us the example of the deer and the lion and dissolving vinegar in honey and so on and so forth. And then he comes to a point which is one of the most remarkable points that he makes in this regard. He says, when you say that, for example, John died, a certain person died. Now, grammatically, John is the subject, and died is, of course, the verb. So apparently you think that somebody is the agent, as has done something. But in reality, when you say that he died, it is not an action on the part of John. It is actionless, actually, because he has died out and he has lost everything. Let us read his own wording. Zayd died. Zayd is like John, the name of somebody. If Zayd is the agent, grammatical subject, I mean, you say that Zayd died, okay, but provided Zayd is the agent, the grammatical subject, yet he is not the agent, for he is defunct. He is the agent only respect of the grammatical expression, otherwise he is the one acted upon, and death is his slayer. What agent is he, since he has been so overpowered, and all the qualities of an agent have been removed from him? You understand? One has to be very careful. When we say that the world exists, this, according to Rumi, is exactly like when you say John died. Existence here is not an action or a characteristic on the part of the world. It is exactly like the grammatical subject of the proposition when you say Zayd died, for example. So apparently, ostensibly, you have got something who is the subject of the proposition, but in reality there is nothing. Actually, you are issuing the creed or the decree that he is nothing. Now, for Rumi, not only it is ontologically correct that the world does not exist and it is nothing that you compare it with God, and it is all actually negated and annihilated, resolved into the entity of God, it has also a ethical dimension as well, which is worth noting. For him, making oneself subordinate to others or subjugating oneself to other slaves of God is not a right action to do, because everything is to be expected from and no one else. So it is unethical, according to him, to be humble, to humiliate oneself in front of anybody other than God. So this nothingness actually is really something which, philosophically correct, but it is the foundation for a kind of ethical behavior towards other people. And not only this, he actually sees it very literally. There is two lines in Rumi's Divan, actually, not in his Masnavi, which tells us very, very clearly what he thought about the present in this world. He said that now we have got ink, and we have got wine, we have got candle, we have got a sweetheart here. If you do not come, these do not matter. And if you do come, these do not matter either. You see the image, it's so powerful. His presence is everything. If you do not come, these do not matter. If you do come, these do not matter either. Therefore, other things are really virtually nothing. Without you, they are nothing. And with you, they are nothing. So that is the whole thing for Rumi. And this is really the real vision of a lover who thinks of the generosity of the beloved and even not of his or her justice. So this will be our last word now. Thank you very much.
Before we move on to questions, I would like to thank Professor Sarouche for highlighting several points, such as the comments about the emphasis of generosity over justice within Rumi, on your own commentary on the story of the shepherd, and Moses highlighting the distinctions between the prophet and the lover, the theologian and the mystic, and also just in general Rumi's use of metaphor and language in approaching God in general. Are there any questions at this time? Yes.
Well, I was just wondering, in the sort of closing of what you're saying, there seems to be a great deal of passivity in the message. We matter, we don't matter. Either way, we don't matter. So I was wondering, in light of our, we do live in time and in space, and we do somehow or another affect at least our own lives, our immediate world we live on, is the perpetuation of war irrelevant in light of that passivity? Do we not play a role? Do we play a role in the perpetuation of conflicts between one another, or is it irrelevant?
No, it is not irrelevant, but definitely he was aware of all this. But let us be careful of the levels of engagement in life. On the social level, of course, we have got all these concepts of war, of violence, of peace, of social relationships, of marriage, of divorce, of this, of that. And actually, mysticism or reason or the love theory of Rumi, it is not a social theory. In order to resolve conflicts, in order to solve these problems, social problems, economical problems, none of this. He doesn't have any pretensions to that, and we should not expect it. So let us not take it as a social theory in order to tell us, to show us how to treat these problems, trouble, things like that. This is for the individual. I mean, the individual actually becomes, according to him, a lover. He looked at himself as a dependent entity rather than an independent entity. So the individual actually finds himself, according to Rumi, and corrects his self. And now, when this self, these corrected selfages in the society find each other and treat each other, a different society altogether will emerge. So that is the outcome of this theory. Let us not expect it to solve economical problems or souls or dispute or what not. That is not the fascist theory. It is in order to correct our image. It is in order to tell us who we are, what is our relationship with our Creator, our beloved, and so on and so forth. And when a society, a community, a group of people are actually being in life, are being taught to look at them from the, then a kind of social relationship will emerge in that community, which is the come of this self-image, of this love, and so on and so forth. That's easy. And of course, for Rumi, the word passivity you used, I mean, he takes it very seriously. He is not shy to tell us that yes, according to him, yes, actually the word idleness. But then we have to know what he means by this. It doesn't mean to be idle, to be, indifferent. What he means is, of course, you will become different. Things which are now so important to you will become unimportant. Things which are very unimportant to you now will become important. So you will become altogether a very different person under this. you see teachings and doctrines or indoctrinatings, and therefore your whole world become different. So you weigh things in a different way. So you will become idle in the eyes of the people who takes things, I mean, differently or weigh differently or value them differently. Of course.
My first language, Urdu, I can make out a few of the words. Could you kindly translate the couplet that you've written on the blackboard?
A couplet? Oh, this
yes.
One. I haven't put this here, but I can tell you. This means that if the thirsty are looking for water, water also is looking for the thirsty. Yeah, these two are in mutual quest of each other. That is, so this is a theory of Rumi actually about love. He says love is not unidirectional. It is always mutual. If loves the beloved, be certain that the beloved also loves the lover. But he goes on to say that actually the love has got two pillars. One of the pillars resides in the beloved, the other resides in the lover. So these two actually love each other, directly, indirectly, I mean, openly or secretly or whatever. But it is in both places. Because in most of the, at least in Arab and Persian literature, of which I am more familiar, usually love is depicted as a unidirectional. A lover always loves the beloved, but sometimes the beloved does not pay attention to the lover, even does not know his lover or her lover. So he just goes on for himself or herself, and the lover is lamenting and things. But according to Rumi, that cannot be the case. And then he gives these examples, that it is like the water and the thirsty. So these two actually are looking for each other, and at last they will find each other. Then he says, of course, when that's the result, that he wants to say that if, I mean, by chance or whatever, I mean, you come to love God, so you must know that God also loves you, because it is mutual always. It cannot be, yes, unidirectional.
Yes.
Along the same lines of the previous comments that you made in answer to the gentleman's question, I'm wondering if the relations between humans should also be characterized by generosity in the same way that God is generous. Should humans strive to be generous towards one another?
No, it's absolutely wrong. We are no gods. We are human beings, and our ethics and our logic is absolutely different from God's ethics and God's logic. So this, we have to be very careful about it. yes, God has created man on his image, but he has created us on his image, but we have got our own ethics. In the case of us, justice is more important than generosity. But in the case of God, generosity is more important than justice. We should not compare ourselves with God. So we have to look at the people, what they deserve, what they do not deserve. You cannot be generous towards a criminal. You cannot be generous towards a murderer or somebody who violates the right of human beings. Generosity here is injustice. In the case of God, it's absolutely different. It's absolutely different. As I said, his ethics is very different. I mean, supposedly, according to the all religions, God is there and he has got every right to take over life. But and we do not call him a murderer, you see, because his relationship with his creation is very different. He is the owner. We are his property, so to speak. But we do not have the right to take the life of anybody, you see. So ours is very different from his. He can and he will actually forgive the sins of people, but sometimes we are not to forgive the sins of some people, their misbehavior, their misdoings. We have to, anyway, sometimes punish them in order to prevent them from doing this again, or imprison them, or even give them life sentence or execution or whatever. This is justice to be done to them. We cannot be generous to them, but God can be generous to them. Yes. So generosity is the main characteristic or the main pillar of divine ethics. But as far as us human beings are concerned, natural beings are Thus, this is the main virtue of humans. God is not a social entity, social being. He's personal, he's individual. He's very different from us. So remember, his ethics is very different from human beings, and therefore neither we have to try to resemble him, nor he tries to resemble us, or to become close to us from this point of view. Ontologically, yes. From the point of view of love, yes. We can draw closer and closer to him. But ethics, especially social ethics, is an independent issue and is not to be conflated with divine ethics.
Yes, please.
So, if you look at Abraham or Christ, what would that be, generosity or justice? How would this compare to?
What do you mean?
Dying
on the cross
for love. Love of human beings.
Well, I mean, it is the business of a lover to die for his beloved. I mean, it is nothing wrong with it. No, let me say something.
Would that be the position of to is that how would we view Christ then as a human being or as?
Well, that is a theological question. According to Christianity, of course, he was a true God from the true God, according to what they say. According to Muslims and Jews, no, he was a human being. He was a prophet, of course, according to Muslims, a great prophet of God, but he was no God at all. And as you know, I mean, it is very clearly in Quran that لَمْ يَلَدْ وَلَمْ يُولَدْ. I mean, God is, Allah is not the father of anybody, and he does not beget any son or something. So this is being recited every day in Quran and in the prayers. So that is altogether a theological question. But let me say something relevant to this point from Rumi. You know, Rumi was fond of Christ, not because he thought that he was God or the Son of God, no, but because of his action and his actually personality. He thought that Christ, Jesus, was not a human being. He thought that he was an angel in disguise. Really, I mean, he mentioned this very clearly. Isi amad dar bashar jense malak. Jesus among us was an angel in disguise. So, because his birth was unusual and his death was also unusual on both counts. I mean, in Christianity, he was killed on cross, and according to Islamic tradition, he was taken to heavens, you see. And his life also was very unusual, all miraculous somehow. And because of this, he thinks that Jesus was a different person altogether. Even though he was not a God, but he was not a human being either. So in between, he was an angel, according to him. And then about the death of Jesus on Christ, on the cross. Well, there actually he says something very refreshing, I would say. Let me read you the poem that is in Divan, it's not in Masnavi. He says, On Guman Tarsa Barad, Mu'min Nadarad On Guman Ku Masih Khishtan Ra Bar Saliba Mi Kushan. This is the suppositions of the Christians. The true believers do not think like this. God does not kill his lover on the cross. You see, he said that Christ or Jesus was the lover of God, and God is not a person, a beloved, who kills his lovers. I mean, instead, he resurrects them. He gives them a second life. Okay? So according to him, yes, Jesus was a lover of God. He was a prophet. He criticizes the Trinity of Christianity, criticizes the idea of the sonhood of Christ and all that, but nevertheless he respects, of course, Jesus very much, and he likes the humility of the Christianity. In one of the stories, I mean, Rumi says that to his son, that I was crossing the road and a Christian priest came to me, and he declared respect to me after respect, bowed in front of me, And then Rumi says, I did the same 100 times more to him in order to tell him that we are even more humble. So he respects and likes the humility and the mercy of the Christians, at least the Christian monks and priests. But his idea of Jesus, of course, was the orthodox idea of any Muslim, that he's a respectable prophet of God.
His passion is what the Sufis would consider the...
Passion of whom? Passion of...
Christ. His...
Well, according to...
His death, his dying for the sins of humans.
This is not... No, this is not the conviction of Muslims. A Muslim Sufi does not think like that. No.
It's not the same love as the Sufi.
No, not the same love. I mean, because the story, according to the Islamic literature, is not true. They do not think that Jesus died for human beings and for their sins to be redeemed. No, that is not according to Muslims. They think that he was taken to heavens. So there was no, issue of death on the cross, nothing like that, no. This passion is not there.
Speaking of the martyrdom of Jesus, makes me think of the martyrdom of the Sufi, martyr Halaj. Now, what has Rumi to say about Halaj, that who also died on the cross, and how does that fit into his theory that God is the only agent? How does he explain the execution of Halaj?
Explain or justify. Actually, he both explains and justifies the martyrdom, if you like, or the hanging of Halaj. well, actually, he has got a high idea of Al-Halaj and his martyrdom, and he thinks that people who actually hanged him were wrong. But you see, his justification for Al-Hallaj, when he said he was God, is this: that at that time he really felt that he was God. Because for Sufis, all is mystical experience. He experienced divinity at the time that he claimed that he was God. And because of that, he was justified. And he thinks that others are not justified because they are mere followers, imitators, and they do not have such an experience. So they are forbidden to do that. It is not for me to say that I am God, because I do not have such a divine experience of myself, and for you as well. But it was, there for the Halaj. He really felt, he really found himself to be God. At that time, he said that he was one with God, and therefore, even according to Rumi, it was not Halaj who was saying that he was God. It was God who was talking through his mouth. He was a mouthpiece of God at that time, according to Rumi. Therefore, he was absolutely right when he was saying that. This martyrdom, yes. You see, for the difference between this Al-Hallaj saying he was God and the Jesus in Christianity, according to Rumi and all others, is this: that all of us are potentially sons of God. All of us may sometimes experience some sort of divinity, and at that time we are absolutely justified to say that we are gods, because as I said, at that time we become mouthpieces of God. But in Christianity, it was only Christ who was the Son of God. Others are not. So that is really the difference. And this, you may take it as a kind of pantheism, but of course they do not like the word. But that is really what Rumi means when he says that Halaj was justified. Also, he mentions Bayazid, another Sufi of the second, of the third century, that also he said that لَيْسَ فِي جُبَّةِ سَوَى اللَّهِ, in my clothes lies God. God is there. And that also Rumi justifies. And he said, yes, he was justified saying that. But others are not.
Yes, I'm here.
About God's ethics and the ethics of humans.
Yes.
There
is what?
Turkish proverb.
Yeah.
maybe you would know this verse, but it's related to it necessarily. It says, Allah to Makra Fera, Umunkla Fetness. So God forgives what is owed to him, but not what one subject owes the other.
Well, I...